afternoon. I'm calling the Senate Community Regional Affairs Committee to order. Today is Tuesday, April 27th. Let the record reflect the time is 3:30 p.m. Today we have President Vice Chair Senator Myers, Senator Gray Jackson, and myself, Chair Hughes. Please remember to silence or turn off your cell phone. Today we are grateful that we have Christopher Dickrell with Senate Records. Carson, I'm not sure if I can read his last name, with the legislative information, your last name, and Dawson Manor aide. We have two items on the agenda. First, we'll hold a hearing for HB 10, Hunter Bay Marine Park, Unagen Cemetery by Representative Hannon, and we'll take up then, following a new committee substitute for Senate Bill 81, Village Public Safety Officer Grants by Senator Olson, and walk through a summary of changes to the bill. This committee substitute was distributed to members electronically, so I'm hopeful that you all had time to review it. We'll then hear invited testimony on the bill. So we're ready to rock and roll. We'll now start with HB 10, Hunter Bay Marine Park. I'd like to invite Representative Hannon and her staff, Tim Clark, to the table. Welcome. Very happy to have you with us over in the belt on the Senate side today to have a House bill before us. That's exciting. So, and I maybe butchered up the pronunciation of the cemetery, and for that I apologize. But Representative Hannon, just so you know, you also have invited testimony. Ricky Gies, Director of the Division of State Parks, and Preston Crowe, Southeast Regional Superintendent, Alaska State Park. So with that, put yourself on the record. You know the routine, and proceed with introducing your bill to us, please, today.
Thank you, Senator Hughes, and members of the committee. Thank you for hearing House Bill 10. I'm Sarah Hannon. I represent House District 33, which is parts of Juneau and northern southeast communities, Haines, Skagway, Cluckwan, and Gustavus. And I actually think that Senator Hughes may have a hometown advantage of actually knowing the place that I'm talking about, which is Hunter Bay, which is on the northern tip of Admiralty Island, the Mansfield Peninsula. And if you were a crow and flying there, it's due west about 15 miles. But if you were an Anungan from the Pribilof Islands being forced to relocate during World War II, it's an ocean away and a completely different ecosystem and environment. For Senator Wilson and Senator Hoffman, they might have a little deja vu. This bill was heard in the 31st legislature, made it through a committee and a half on the Senate side before it died last March in Senate Finance. So I'll start at the very beginning.
You start at the very beginning, I'll just momentarily interrupt to put on the record that Senator Wilson has joined us, and also to comment that we had quite a few pieces of legislation that died due to COVID and what happened last March. So continue, please.
Came to rest there. So Hunter Bay is the physical location of what was two relocation camps during World War II, and it's the Anungan people from St. Paul and St. George in the Pribilofs who were relocated there. So this bill, in sort of, is in the history perspective, is 79 years in the making, because it was 1942, shortly after the Japanese bombing of Dutch Harbor and the capture of Attu and Kiska. The U.S. military immediately made a decision to evacuate all the remaining folks that they could get to on the Aleutian Islands and in the Pribilof, St. Paul and St. George. And there were eventually six relocation camps here in southeast Alaska. Two were in Hunter Bay. Hunter Bay is a fairly good-sized bay. There was an abandoned cannery on the north side of the bay and an abandoned mine on the south side of the bay. Those two camps shared one cemetery. Further south on Admiralty Island, in front of the village of Angoon, was in Killisnoo, was another relocation camp. There was one in Wrangell, at the Wrangell Institute, across from Wrangell in Burnett Inlet. That Burnett Inlet location doesn't exist anymore. The cannery there burned down. Wrangell Institute, people could go into town. Their dead were put into the cemetery in Wrangell. Then there was one in Ketchikan at Ward Cove, which had been a CCC camp, so was in pretty good standing. in those other locations, in those, they were closer to communities with access to resources, assistance, medical help, potential for jobs, kids going to town for school. In Funter Bay, that was not the case. The cannery that was the location of the largest site of the two camps in Funter Bay had already been abandoned for over a decade. Canneries were always seasonal operations, but one of the things they need, so they were never built for year-round habitation, but they need a lot of fresh water to operate a good cannery. And the Funter Bay site did not have a source of good water. So that cannery had been out of operation for over a decade, had already fallen into grave disrepair when several hundred people are dropped there in a completely different ecosystem and basically abandoned by the U.S. government and told to fend for themselves. This bill would move 251 acres of state land that is in Funter Bay into an existing state marine park that already exists, that's over 1,000 acres. That marine park was created in the early 1980s and has been there. Funter Bay has a number of private parcel lands around it, some old mining claims on the south side of the bay, federal land backing behind it, and sort of three pockets of state land. When this bill came to me via constituents, the idea for a bill, and we contacted the State Department of Natural Resources, it was at that point that DNR suggested that the remaining parcels of state land in Funter Bay all be moved in to the state park. That gave them efficiency of management, so it was no longer two state agencies to have oversight, because there was already oversight by state parks for the marine park for the majority of state land in Funter Bay. And this would just move it all in there. This will protect the cultural, social, and historical significance of the cemetery. Like I said, those two relocation camps were the largest. They had almost 500 people there. One of the other things that's sort of ugly in the Funter Bay camp's history is that the men of the camp, the men from St. Paul and St. George, were forced every summer to return to the Pribilofs to conduct the federal seal harvest, because at that point in time, the U.S. government still operated a commercial sealing operation out of St. Paul and St. George. So in the summers, when typically someone surviving in this ecosystem would be out harvesting deer, berries, and fish, what was left at camp were the children, the women, and the aged. And instead of being able to build up their subsistence stores and resources to survive through the winter, they were left to survive in a camp that was a wet, dark ecosystem without the foods that they were used to, in pretty deplorable conditions for health, and had a substantial death rate. So from 1942, the first headstone that shows there is a baby that died in the fall of 1942, a few months into the relocation, and then continued. The other camps were able to return home to their communities 2 years earlier than the survivors in the Funter Bay location. They were held for an additional 2 years beyond when the U.S. government allowed people to return to the Aleutian Island villages. But the Pribilof residents weren't. So this bill preserves the land, puts it into an existing state park, and is at the request of the survivors' descendants of the families who have members buried at the Funter Bay Unungan Cemetery. And I can go on into my lengthy U.S. Alaska history in World War II, but I won't torture you with that. We do have a short PowerPoint to give you some idea of, we think we got the maps in there, and we do have the state director of parks online, as well as the regional director, if you have questions about the specifics of the layout of it.
So may I ask, so the presentation and then the folks online, they're not going to be talking so much about the history. You've done that. So what I'd suggest is, if there are any questions related to her history, that we ask those now. Does anyone have any questions regarding the history? Well, I do. So you mentioned that the first grave marker had 1942 of a little baby. What was that the same year that they were relocated, 1942?
It was June of 1942.
Okay, and then you stated that that they were returned 2 years later than some of the other groups had been relocated. Was that 2 years following the war? So was that 1947? Or
started in 1944, some of the people from other locations were allowed to return home. The military threat of the Aleutians went faster, clearing of it and making it safer. So people from Dutch Harbor were able to return home in 1944.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I know we're going to talk about the maps and the land, but this somewhat relates to the histories of having the, is there any kind of formal designation of the cemetery as a historical site? Does that need to happen? And does it have a formal name? And are you envisioning some kind of historical, I don't know, you know, like a nice gates around it or something like that to I know. I think I heard that it was overgrown and found how many years ago?
Well, so Senator, it's always been known. The issue is that Funter Bay is a little bit out of the way. The families were from the Pribilofs, so many families did return to the western part of Alaska. But there's, you know, many continue to live here in Southeast, particularly here in Juneau. The Russian Orthodox Church has always had a memorial. So it's always been known. Mm-hmm. What's sort of been talked about in the last decade or so is protection of them and acknowledgement. A lot of people, including Alaskans, don't understand that the war, World War II in Alaska, had very dramatic impacts and forced relocations and people moving around. The cemetery will have protection in its permanence by becoming part of the state park that will acknowledge it. But it is a rural park, a rustic, undeveloped park. There's no shoreside development at that state park. There's no picnic tables or designated campgrounds. So if you kayaked over there, there's a state marine park with some beaches that you could pull up on, but there's no sign that says State Marine Park. There is a group of, and it's called the Funter Bay Working Group, that have started maintaining it, cleaned up the grave sites, and it's 5-6 years ago, 2017, that the Russian Orthodox Church, working with the descendants, organized a memorial trip, took a Russian Orthodox priest over there. They cleaned up the headstones. Many of them had fallen into the moss, set them up, put Russian Orthodox crosses on all the grave sites that they could find that were marked. The Funter Bay Working Group, affiliated with a group of volunteers at Friends of Admiralty Island, is what they call themselves, are planning to put some historical markers and signage to identify. Because what, you know, has come is that some people, just thinking they're walking through the woods in Funter Bay where they've come ashore, have stumbled upon a grave yard that they think no one knows about because there are no markings. Mm-hmm. But the state parks is not going to increase any development at the site. There is no state park signage that's going up. Go ahead. Tim participates in the working group, and I know they had a meeting this week. So,
okay. Yes. Tim?
For the record, Tim Clark, staff to Representative Hannon. The working group is very active, still meeting on a weekly basis, and it has been meeting for at least 3 years now, I believe. It is spearheaded by stakeholders who include descendants of people who were interred in the camp, other people from Unalaska, Akutan, the Aleutian chain, whose families suffered similar fates, and also the Friends of Admiralty, which includes some of the private landowners in Funter Bay, and the City Museum of Juneau, right across the street from the Capitol, where they've been very much involved in an extensive exhibition on the relocation historical issues, and are also contributing to, you know, the texts and such that will be included in the signage. It's also notable that some of the signage will help identify the a short trail from the beach to the cemetery itself, which will is also good in that it will, people who are there to visit will have better guidance to the trailhead and will do sort of less wandering around, less likelihood of wandering onto private property, that sort of thing. So it is a very dedicated group of people from, you know, stretching all the way from St. Paul and St. George to Unalaska to Juneau. And I should also include that there are many members of the working group who are part of the Tlingit and Haida community in Southeast, where there is a very strong bond that was established back in the 40s when Tlingit people helped give it with aid to the Onagan people in Funter Bay with food and blankets and other things.
Well, it's very fascinating to hear this history, and not only do I have connections as far as my roots here, but I didn't realize this was were families from St. George and St. Paul, and my husband has spent, not in recent years, but in early years in the 70s and 80s and 90s, time going out to the do medical care out on those islands with descendants, very likely, of folks that were involved. So, yes, it would be. How long does it take to get from Juneau to there if you would go by water?
Well, it depends on the speed, Senator. It's the speed of your boat, of course. You know, you have to go up around Point Retreat in the north end of Admiralty Island and then come down. So, you know, it could be just a 30 to 40 minute run if you've got a fast boat. I'd say it's more like an hour, hour and a half. I've always had slower boats. Most of the people who have places in Funter Bay, you know, if we're going to call them recreational homes or cabins, there's enough water weather, you know, as Admiralty goes north into Lynn Canal, that it's not something that people generally do, oh, I'm going to the cabin for the weekend. And it's more not the distance, it's the waterway. You've got to get around Point Retreat and then back down, and you're facing out towards Icy Strait. So all the water that comes to the inside passage from the outer coast on the north end of Southeast comes in through Icy Straits and then either goes up Lynn Canal or down Stevens Passage or down Chatham Strait. So it's a lot of tides, and that's one of the dilemmas in judging when you're going to come around Point Retreat. And, you know, you want to go north on that outgoing tide, but now you're turning and coming south and dipping into Funter Bay. And Funter Bay is a pretty amazing deep harbor in an edge where there aren't a lot of very deep bays around there. So it is a long-used traditional hunting and boating area, you know, from Tlingit times forward because of the natural setting of that bay. So, you know, it depends on the tides, the winds, and the water. It's close, but it's a long ways away.
Well, thank you for that. It might be an idea for another field trip for the CNR. A committee, and we'd want to make sure we timed it, as you said, as far as how the tides go. So, Tim, if you want to continue with pick up, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I could just run through this PowerPoint quickly.
Oh, I did have one more history question. I'm sorry, just remember, I looked at my notes. How many graves? What's the count?
Thank you. Senator Hughes, you would assume that that's an easy answer to give. But it's a little more complex. And so generally, there's 32 marked graves. But what is said is that that's not a very accurate number because there are some graves that weren't marked. And there were some families who came back and moved their dead into a cemetery here where there was a Russian Orthodox priest. The U.S. Park Service a few years ago took on looking at all the relocation camps to try and determine whether they could get historical preservation through federal guidelines and such. And that's where they said there are 32 documented graves, but that's not an absolutely accurate number.
Okay, thank you for that. Go ahead, Tim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this PowerPoint, for the most part, it's information that the representative has already given the committee. However, it does provide a few visual aids. And you can see here this photograph of the cemetery in 2017. That was when I believe there was a 75th anniversary ceremony out there where I accompanied then Speaker Edgman, along with many of our constituents from the Purple Office, our then constituents from the Purple Office and elsewhere out west. And well, it was a very moving experience because it also included Tlingit elders, Russian Orthodox church officials, and a lot of very interested and sympathetic parties that were there. And a large cross to mark the cemetery was that was made by, I believe, prisoners at the Lemon Creek Correctional Center here was put in place at that time. I think you know at this point what the bill accomplishes in terms of the transfer of land. This next slide just gives you a kind of perspective in terms of the location of Funter Bay and the cemetery in relation to Juneau, and you can see the necessity of having to go around Admiralty Island, you know, to reach it. This is a sort of rather crude close-up of from a map that, in its entirety, was also provided to the committee. And you can see that these sections marked A01, both the section to the west and this section to the east, also A01, are now sort of made more continuous and more contiguous and more, you know, efficient to manage, arguably, now that A02 sort of joins up the two areas of the park that used to have a gap, so to speak.
It almost looks like is there still a bit of a gap?
That gap is, yes, Madam Chair, that gap is private land. So you'll see that there are areas both to the, almost within the park, so to speak, grandfathered in, that is private land, and certain areas to the west as well, where there are private land holdings. And I believe that this larger area of yellow-colored geography is native corporation holdings. But here too are, I believe this is the headstone that Representative Hannon was referring to earlier, where the death was October 14th of...
That's 43.
Of 43. Well, it may not be that headstone in particular, but... And there are still to this day some remnants of the remaining cannery buildings, obviously in worse shape than they were in 1942, but in 1942, by all accounts, their condition was very sad indeed. But, and here, finally, is another graphic showing the location not only of the Funter Bay internment camp, but also the one at Killis New, the one at Wrangell Institute, Burnett Inlet, and Ward Lake, the other internment camps where people were relocated at that time. And that's the extent of our PowerPoint.
Okay, thank you. And so we have invited testimony. Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Myers has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the question is, I noticed that we already have an existing Funter Bay Park, and we're expanding it. I'm curious, though, as the description that I'm getting of the area, not having been there myself, is that it's relatively isolated, and I'm just curious why, when the original park was created, and why. It doesn't sound like there's a whole lot of structures or anything there. I'm curious why the state would create a park there.
I do know, through the chair, Senator Hughes, Senator Myers, the park, the Funter Bay Marine Park, was created in 1983. Now, I am not sure of why it was created, but I do know that it was created as a rural marine park. And I presume that much of it was that there was private parcel holdings already existing there, that it's a very cherished harbor. The state maintains, has two docks over there. So I sort of presume that the goal was to make sure that boaters would always have some access, that it wasn't all private land. We do have the regional director of parks on board. I don't believe he was there in 1983 with state parks, but I bet in his schooling up of land management and park plans that he's had to resurrect that history at some point. And that would be Preston, if we want to ask him.
All right. Preston, did you hear Senator Myers' question, or do you like it repeated? Preston Crows?
Hi, Madam Chair. Hughes, yep, this is Preston Crews with Alaska State Parks. Last name is spelled K-R-O-E-S for the record. To address that question, it was created just like any other state park, just in order to set aside state lands for the purpose of recreation. We have multiple state marine parks around the state, but more notably, in the Juneau area, we have St. James Bay, Taku Harbor, obviously Funter Bay, Pavlaw Harbor, and the 14 Channel Islands just outside of Ock Bay here in Juneau.
Okay, thank you.
All right, and so I do have Ricky Geese. You're signed up to provide testimony, is that correct? If you'd like to introduce yourself and your role and give your testimony, please.
Sure. For the Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Ricky Geese. I'm the Director of Parks and Outdoor Recreation for DNR. And the Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation wishes to go on the record in supporting this legislation. We would be pleased to accept the management responsibility for the site, which is very important to the history of our state and to the culture and memory of the Unangan people. Our Southeast staff, led by Preston, who you've met, is our superintendent for the Southeast region. We've been working with many organizations and individuals for a way to provide better management and protection of this significant historic cultural resource. It's been a privilege for us to coordinate and work with the diverse groups of knowledgeable people and enthusiastic people, agencies and organizations. And we would be happy to answer any questions that you have on the particulars of it. For the fine details, Preston would be the go-to person on who he's coordinating with in the interpretation and education plans that we have moving forward.
Okay. I'm not seeing questions from committee. I'll ask you, Ricky. Well, first, thank you for being here, but also, when did it first come, the request for this addition come to you, and who brought it?
I am going to defer that question to Preston because it was a House bill before I became director of State Parks. So if you don't mind, Madam Chair, I'll defer that answer to Preston, please.
Okay, thank you. And Preston, if you want to answer that and also give any testimony that you have, please identify yourself initially.
Thank you, Chair Hughes. Again, Preston Crews with Alaska State Parks, Southeast Regional Superintendent. To address that question, it was originally brought to my attention within a few weeks of me starting as the superintendent approximately 3.5 years ago. We have a citizens advisory group that meets monthly. Martin Stepton, whose grandparents were both at the internment camp, approached our advisory board prior to me even, you know, being stationed here in Juneau, and was trying to work with them to come up with a solution to protect the cemetery. When I joined in, I offered as a possible solution to have that parcel joined into the existing state park to provide that better protection that they were seeking. They had also prior to that tried to have it deemed a national landmark, but their efforts for one reason or another fell short and they weren't able to have that accomplished, which is something that, you know, we've also discussed that we might approach again here in the future and see if we can actually have that happen. I guess I'd also like to take this opportunity to maybe clarify a few other questions that and thoughts that each of you had already brought up. The name would not change. It would still remain Funter Bay State Marine Park. Obviously, the cemetery would be a historic site within that park, and we are developing the four interpretive panels directly with the tribal elders and members out from St. Paul and St. George to eventually be placed out there in Funter Bay. We've been part of the working group that Tim Clark had mentioned ever since it started. We've been actually one of the, I guess, the main anchors, state parks and our advisory board, working with that larger group. There was a question about funding and improving the cemetery and area. We've already discussed that. Obviously, this bill has no funding attached to it, but we are hoping in the future to use our recreational trail grant program to get some funding to improve the trail system, maybe reroute it away from the cemetery and not directly through it, and to make some improvements and maintenance improvements to the cemetery itself. It currently has that old wooden picket fence and archway that we're hoping to maybe improve or possibly improve and again install these interpretive panels.
Thank you for that, Preston. And we have other work to do before the committee, but it's been very, very fascinating to learn this piece of history. And one of the things, and we can talk about it offline or if there's a process, but I'd be curious if the working group stakeholders would want to have a formal name for the cemetery, perhaps in the statute as well, if that might be something you think about and get back with us. I don't know if there's been a discussion, but I, you know, if legally we can do that, I think that would make sense. So it's because it is a historical site, having it named in statute would seem like the honorable thing to do. So with that, at this time, we are going to set this bill aside. And members, please note that amendments on this bill are due to my office by Monday, May 3rd at 5 p.m. So thank you very much.
Thank you all.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
It always spurs a history teacher's heart when people are interested in history. So thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank members you, Ricky and Preston. We appreciate you joining us. We're going to now move on to SB 81 Village Public Safety Officer Grants by Senator Olson. We heard this bill for the first time Tuesday, April 20th. Yes, Senator Olson and Ken, please come forward and join us at the table. The committee substitute presented before us is based off the recommended changes provided by the sponsor's office. So as they're getting situated, I will turn to my vice chair, Senator Myers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that the committee substitute for Senate Bill 81, Work Order 32-LS0362/I, be adopted as the working document.
And I will object for purposes of discussion. And to kick off that discussion, I will turn to Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and members of the Committee on Regional Affairs Committee. Senate Bill 81 has been one of the things that's been a working bill in progress. We had the identical bill passed last year, except for the committee substitute that has just been adopted. This act essentially is requiring background investigations on VPSO officer applicants by the Department of Public Safety, which is relating to the VPSO program and providing for an effective date. With that, I'll turn it over to my staff, Ken Truitt, to go ahead and fill you in on the details of what we are representing.
Thank you, Ken. Please put yourself on the record.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Ken Truitt, staff to Senator Olson. As we mentioned at the initial bill hearing, as we ran through the bill in its original form, we mentioned that there was interest by the stakeholders to have the feature that moved management of the grant to the Department of Commerce to take that out of the bill and keep the management of the grant with the Department of Public Safety. And that's exactly what the committee substitute that you have just, or you are in the process of adopting, accomplishes. It does that by removing all references to the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. The only section that's impacted in toto in the bill is the former Section 5, which was a proposed amendment to the Department of Commerce's enabling statute that gave it specific authority to manage this grant. That section, former Section 5, has been removed, and the remaining four sections have been renumbered accordingly. And that's the total process, that's the total of the changes in this particular version. Thank you.
Thank you for that explanation, Ken. I want to note if the committee have any further questions before we adopt that we have Lieutenant Eric Olson with Alaska Public Safety and Elizabeth Danesky with the Department of Public Safety online for any questions. So are there any questions about this committee substitute? Seeing none, I'll remove my objection. And seeing no other objection, the committee substitute is adopted as our working document. So, Senator Olson, I just want to, and Mr. Truitt, let you know that we have a number of invited testimony. So if we have Jason Wilson, Mike Nemeth, and Daryl Hildebrand, and then I don't know if Lieutenant Eric Olson and Elizabeth Danesky are for that purpose also. Would you like us to move to that, or do you have anything additional you'd like to share with us?
I think we're ready for the invited testimony, Madam Chair, and the Alaska State Troopers are there just for questions.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so we'll start with Jason Wilson. Jason, welcome to the Community Regional Affairs. Please identify yourself and provide your affiliation and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jason Wilson. Did you need me to spell that out?
No.
I couldn't.
We've got it. Thank you.
Okay, I apologize. Senator Hughes and members of the committee, Community and Regional Affairs Committee, good to teach and how well for the opportunity to speak with you today on Senate Bill 81. First, I'd like to take a moment to acknowledge and honor the Akwam people and the Takukwam people and say thank you for allowing us to conduct business on their traditional lands. Again, my name is Jason Wilson. I'm Tlingit. I'm Eagle Killiwhale. My Tlingit name is Ketchikat Yeesh. I serve as the manager of Clinton Heights Public Safety Department and have the privilege of overseeing the VPSO program. I've been the VPSO coordinator for roughly 16-ish years. I've seen many governors, commissioners, and colonels in my time. Clinton High is the largest tribe in Alaska with over 32,000 enrolled tribal citizens across the state of Alaska and the nation and the world. Only a handful of our communities are connected with the road system and are most accessible through the boat or plane. The VPSO program fills a critical need in these communities as they don't have direct access to Alaska State Troopers or other public safety infrastructures. With Clink and Haida, we currently have 10 VPSOs in the communities of Heidelberg, Saxman, Cake, Angoon, Pelican, Kasan, and Thorn Bay. We've been very fortunate over the last year in filling our vacancies and very excited about what they're doing in their communities. I do want to say thank you again thank you so much for considering this bill. We are pleased to testify today in support of SB 81. This bill has been in the works for quite some time. I can't say thank you enough to Senator Olson and his staff for the work that they've put in and really the constant emailing with all of our VPSO coordinators as well as the state. In that, I guess one of the big things that stands out to me in helping our program is the government-to-government relations. And what I mean by that is this allowing to have some flexibility within our program to do the things that we feel we need to do in spending or purchasing of items to assist our officers complete their duties. Just some quick background. Over the last few years, we've had different organizations have had different challenges putting in requests for purchases of equipment. That might be something as simple as some tires or other various equipment. I'm sorry, I just went brain dead on you. Various equipment needing to fulfill their duties. So the process went like this. Is basically, we'd have money distributed from the state to our organizations. If we had something fall outside that line or even within that line, we still had to go back and kind of ask for permission to purchase that, whatever that might be. This kind of had a lot of red tape as now we had different people with different interpretations of what needed to be done in our communities. So certain things were denied or approved depending of the time. I'll go to last year and look at last year's. I'll just speak about one subject matter. And recruitment has been a major challenge for our organization, just like most of law enforcement across the United States. Clink and I had requested about $7,000 for recruitment materials and funds. We were given about $2,000. Chugy Attribute was requested a little over $6,000, and they were awarded nothing. I'm not going to go down the list, and this isn't a bash the state. It's more in the lines of here's what the challenge was, and here's what this this bill does is free up and basically says, let's talk with each other. Let's make sure we're doing what we're supposed to do. And then coordinators, go out and do your job, which is fill the VPSO positions and get them the things that they need to do their job. So really, the way I look at this bill is really in simplicity is let's make sure we have some more guidelines. This program was developed in 1978. And there are many statutes that have not been updated, many regulations that have not been updated since then. And so what this bill does is it basically says, okay, let's join into the 2020s and let's provide this program the best way that we possibly can. Let's ensure that just because the changing of a commissioner doesn't change what the view is on how funds need to be distributed. So this kind of gives us a more even keel. And I'm going to go back to the government-to-government relationship. This has already been taking place. Over the last year, we've seen kind of a change in how we communicate with each other what I mean by that is with both with the coordinators as well as the state. Example of proper spending of funds and working together on spending of funds, I look at just a couple of meetings ago, we're looking at funds that are kind of lapsing, what we call lapsed funds in our program. We're looking at making sure that we are still developing our program, purchasing the things that our officers are needing, and working together to do that. And I think that's a major accomplishment. Again, I want to say that Clinton High supports this bill. I also want to say thank you for the opportunity to testify. Clinton High stands committed and partnering with the state to find the solutions to provide public safety to our communities. And lastly, and especially thanks to Senator Olson's office and specifically Ken Truitt for his work and dedication to this issue. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify. If there's questions, I'd be happy to answer those questions if I can. And I'd also, if asked, I would make my information to contact me on the site available. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Jason, if you could stick around, because we'll check for questions after we get through the invited testimony. I believe what I'm hearing Mr. Wilson say, that before the 50th anniversary of the program, he'd like some stability, some standards, some consistency. So with that, we will move next to Mike Nemeth. Mr. Nemeth, please put your name and affiliation on the record and proceed with your testimony this afternoon.
Thank you for having me, Madam Chair. My name is Michael Nemeth. I work for the Aleutian Pribilof Islands Association. Representative Hammond just discussed our region and our region's people. So thank you very much, Representative Hammond. I have been a village public safety officer since 2002. I'm still a certified officer, and I have been the VPSO program coordinator for the Aleutian Pribilof Islands Association for the past 9 years. I'd like to take a moment to thank Senator Olson and the rest of the VPSO Legislative Working Group for their findings, recommendations, and Senate Bill 81. This was a true bipartisan boots-on-the-ground effort, meeting with stakeholders all over Alaska to address the VPSO program. So for that, I thank them. Today, I was hoping to speak about training and the positive change this bill makes to that. As it stands today, the minimum hours of training required for a VPSO is 240 hours, and that's relating to Alaska Administrative Code 13 AAC 96.100. This is shamefully low, but thankfully that's not what we're providing to our officers right now. Right now they're attending the ALIT Academy, which they're receiving approximately just over 1,000 hours at the Academy of Training, plus the 96 hours for the Rural Fire Protection Specialist Training Certification. Some of the programs that have the VPSOs are still providing emergency trauma technician training, but this is no longer program-wide nor required. In the past, interpretation of code and regulation has been inconsistent in decisions to decrease hours of training and removing the requirement of emergency trauma technician for all the VPSOs has been made without consultation. This has directly affected the officers and their ability and knowledge to perform the duties of their position. A great concern is also that the decision may be made to regress at some point to the required minimum of 240 hours. And we feel that's unacceptable. And just even having that in place where somebody can arbitrarily make that decision at some point is a bit shameful. And back to Jason's testimony, a lot of this hasn't been looked at since the 70s and certainly needs to be addressed. In the bill, it's proposing 826 hours of minimum training. 650 of that being law enforcement training. We came up with the 650 hours of law enforcement training because that is the minimum that the Alaska Police Standards Council will accept for a police officer in the state of Alaska. We would like to keep the 96 hours for the Rural Fire Protection Specialist certification, which is required to be a certified VPSO. We would like to see the 40 hours of emergency trauma technician training reinstated as mandatory for the position. Since a VPSO is usually first on scene to all emergencies, including medical, having that not a next level of emergency medical training is very important over, say, basic first aid and CPR training. In my personal experience with over 10 years as a VPSO in two different communities within my region, approximately 50% of my overtime was related to medical emergencies and being first on scene and spending time at the clinic with those emergencies. The final 40 hours in that 826 would be for search and rescue, which is an integral part of the VPSO's duties. Right now at the Alaska Law Enforcement Training Academy, they only receive 8 hours of training in search and rescue. And the bill improves that, since it's an integral part of their duties. And they may be the only trained person on the ground. The proposed new minimum training hours gives the officers the tools and knowledge and confidence needed to fulfill the duties of the position. This will also help with recruitment and retention, ensuring that we can speak to the minimum training that will be provided to applicants and ensuring our officers in the field are confident in performing their duties. It also increases the overall quality of the officer and the services that we can provide. That's all I have, Madam Chair. Unless there are questions, I believe we're holding till the end.
Yes, thank you very much for your testimony. And our final invited testimony for today is Dara Hildebrand. We were going to hold. Is it okay if we hold? Is that okay? So, Daryl Hildebrand, please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, and thank you for having me, Madam Chair. My name is Daryl Hildebrand. I am the DPSO coordinator for Canada Chiefs Conference in Fairbanks. A little bit about my personal experience. I am a retired Alaska State Trooper after serving just over 20 years. I was hired by Canada Chiefs Conference as their VPSO coordinator about a year and a half ago. And today I'm testifying in support of SB 81, specifically one portion which allows for flexibility in the program to allow grantees to utilize the Rover VPSO program. While Rovers were not explicitly prohibited in the previous regulations, administrations viewed the need and the budget from them differently. This bill gives us the ability to build out our program without the fear of changing administrations withholding funding from us for using the Rover program. Rovers would serve multiple communities using less manpower, provide continuity of service, allow for coverage when ASC could not fly into a village due to weather or manpower issues. PCC is the largest region in the state with a great number of villages. We currently have 37 villages with no public safety presence except through the ASC rural visits. Our Alaska State Trooper Rural Services unit is primarily limited to criminal response and are limited numbers in the TCC region. In 2015, TCC restructured our VPSO program by creating regional rover positions. Regional rovers were very effective in fulfilling the public safety needs through both community policing, establishing fire departments, and crime response in our underserved villages. Regional rovers were able to reach more communities with the limited amount of VPSOs we had. One perceived drawback to the rover program was that it created a significant increase in our travel budget. However, it was also found to have a lot of positive outcomes. Community policing, identifying infrastructure and public safety needs throughout the region, developing plans for fire departments, general outreach, and increased law enforcement presence are all benefits of the regional VPSO program. The relationship with our trooper counterparts is strong, and the rover program at TCC has worked in the past. In our region, rover VPSOs would continue to assist the Fairbanks-based Rural Services Unit with responses to investigations, community policing, and acting as backups when needed. Rover VPSOs are the best solution to our high demand and need for VPSOs in our region where we have limited law enforcement resources. Now, in short, SB 81 would allow us to have the flexibility to utilize Rover VPSOs to better serve our communities. I'd like to also thank Senator Olson for all of your hard work on SB 81, and thank you, Madam Chair, for hearing my testimony.
Thank you for being with us today, Mr. Hildebrand. So now we'll take questions. Senator Gray Jackson has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So my question is, I think it's to Mike. And you may have mentioned this in the beginning of your testimony, but I know you said that you were a village public safety officer. And I'm just curious, what community are you a VPSO in?
Yes, Senator, through the chair. I am still a certified village public safety officer, but my main duties right now are as the VPSO program coordinator for the Aleutian-Pribilof Island region. So I am based at our main office. Well, I am based at home right now due to COVID, but usually based at our main office that's in Anchorage, where Anchorage is the hub for our region. But I have served in the community, island community of St. George Island, and in the community of Nelson Lagoon, Alaska, as a village public safety officer. But when I travel as a coordinator to the region to visit my officers, I bring all my gear and I work as a VPSO while I'm in those communities. Senator.
Thank you. Thank you for your service. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Other questions? Senator Wilson, do you have a question?
No, Madam Chair. I just remember serving with Michael during a training at St. George at our joint time at the Primary Care Association.
Okay, excellent. Excellent.
Oh, wow.
I have a question of Michael also, because I was not on the part of the bill when you were talking about the training hours, 826. Are you happy with the way it's laid out, or were you suggesting some changes? Because I think you specified 40 hours for maybe emergency medical services training. Are you suggesting that those be re-looked at just so that the committee and the sponsor might be clear on that?
Madam Chair, that's a good question. I know when we were working with the legislative working group, we were coming up with these hours and that list. And I think if it were within the bill itself, of course, it would be crystal clear. But I think having the minimum of 826 hours and having the opportunity to formulate that training in the list that I provided might be reasonable, but certainly if it were in the bill, it would be cleaner, Madam Chair.
Well, if you want to provide that list and we'll provide it to the sponsor and we can have that conversation, because that could be determined as long as the max hours and gives you enough leeway to fit what you are hoping for. But we'd be happy to look if you want to email it to the committee, which I will just say that committee email for any bill that comes to this committee as SCRA, and that's for Senate Community Regional Affairs, at akleg.gov. My next question is for Mr. Hildebrand. You were talking about regional rovers. Can you tell us, is that provision in the bill, or is that something you're suggesting allowing these rovers?
Madam Chair, this is Darrell Hildebrand, Canada Chiefs. I don't believe that there's specific language relating to rovers in the bill, but what the bill would allow us is the flexibility to work with the program office in developing.
Whoops, you froze up a little bit there, Mr. Hildebrand. I don't know if you can hear me. Perhaps if he can't hear me, maybe the sponsor and his staff could find out. It could be that, or maybe you can answer it, Ms. Senator Olson. Does the bill provide anything that would be prohibitive against regional rovers, or is that something that should be in the bill?
Actually, it's a very good idea, and that was one of the suggestions that came on out, but Mr. Truitt has a better idea on where in the bill it has the suggestion that this would be the way to go.
Mr. Truitt?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Ken Truitt, staff for Senator Olson. And to answer the specific question on page 5, starting on lines 4 through 10 of the bill, it speaks to one village public safety officer per village. And the grant recipient can request more than one. And the justification for that, what the bill does is create flexibility where it removes the prohibition for, because there an administration came in, our witnesses would have to tell me which one, I don't remember, and cut that practice off, prevented them from having these itinerant roving VPSO officers. So I think, and I can get you a more specific location in the bill, but we did craft the bill to specifically make that roving practice acceptable.
And so, you believe it's taken care of already, or do you think clarifying language for that is necessary?
Madam Chair, I think that it's taken care of already, but I'll verify that and communicate back section number and line and page.
Okay. That'd be great. Thank you. Any other comments or questions from committee members? Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment. But my involvement and knowledge of BPSOs was established when I was the finance manager for the city of Accutan from 2009 to 2012. So I want to take a moment to thank Senator Olson for bringing this much-needed bill forward. And I'm also honored to be a co-sponsor of this bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Gray Jackson. Do you have any final comments before we set this bill aside?
Madam Chair, I thank you for the little bit of a time there. If we just keep going on page 5, it's very next section, subsection F, line 11, page 5. A grant recipient may assign a traveling village public safety officer to serve multiple villages within the grant recipient's region. So we don't use the word roving. That was a decision made by Ledge Legal according to their drafting manual. So the word traveling is used in the bill.
Okay, thank you. Since we lost Mr. Hildebrand, maybe you could just fill him in on our conversation and that's in that section. He may have been aware of it. We just didn't hear his answer. So with that, I want to let members know that amendments for this bill will be set tomorrow, the 28th at 5 p.m. So if there's any tweaks that you all need, you please let us know. And then we plan to bring this bill up next Thursday and open public testimony. And then according to the committee will see if we will be moving it out that day. That next Thursday also we will be hearing SB 46, Law Enforcement Registry Use of Force. And that is Senator Gray Jackson's bill. And so seeing no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect. The time is 4:32.